Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 17th of January. It's the last day of the week. It's the last day before a long weekend, long holiday weekend, and last day of last weekday of the Biden administration. And that's all. I will say that we are not going to be here on Monday. We are we have the holiday off. It's the obviously Martin Luther King Day, and we will be off commemorating that day. And also, of course, the inauguration will be taking place, and we'll be covering that throughout the day from National Public Radio. And then on Monday, we'll be back in this room. A whole bunch of people will be coming in on Monday to figure out what exactly was said the day before. So we'll go through that. In the meantime, we have a wonderful group this morning to talk about what's happening, and there is certainly a lot happening. So we will not be pressed to come up with issues. There's certainly much to talk about. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we enjoy and welcome your letters. All right. Also, just before I introduce everybody, I want to remind you about the lockbox. The lockbox is vitally important for our survival. We have a $1.25 million goal in our fund drive for this February, and the official fund drive will begin on February 3rd. With that said, as you know, that's a lot of money, but there's also a lot of news that's going to be made. There's a lot of programs that we would normally run. We want to run as many of those as possible. So every dollar we make today is less that we have to make when the fund drive is on. So if we can shorten that or shorten it to the point where we don't have to have it at all, that would be really wonderful. So if you could do your part now, that would be great. I'll give you two ways to do it. You can give us a call, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. I'll also remind you that you can go online. For some reason, for some of you have been having problems, and we've noticed that a way to fix the problem is if you write the entire address in, which is www.wamc.org. So if you can do that, or if you try WAMC.org and it doesn't work, just try the www first, and you can donate that way. We want to thank all of the folks, so many folks, who have given already, and we thank you very, very much for being a part of the family and for doing your part already. And for those of you who haven't done anything yet, we need you now more than ever. 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you this morning, and we'll get started. I'm excited because it's a great group, and I just want to hear what's on their mind, so we'll get right to it. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everyone. What's on my mind? A long weekend to decompress.
That'll be nice, right?
Yes, yeah. For two reasons, because we have to sort of, you know, gear up for what's to come.
Yes.
And then I start teaching on Tuesday.
Oh, that's so what you got to gear up for.
I got to gear up for that, too. Yes, so we need a little bit of rest. And then I have to say, I'm somewhat happy that D.C. will have bitter cold weather and nasty wind on Monday.
Well, I hope nothing important blows off. But yes, certainly they're going to get weather. We'll get weather. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it all goes. Always wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much. We also welcome Jay Jochniewicz with us. He is semi-retired, but here are all the things that he does do. Editor at large, columnist, and an editorial writer at the Times Union. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well, and I do more than that. I fish chickens. I fetch chickens from trees in the dead of night when they don't get into their coop.
How many? You told me the story, but I didn't ask you how many chickens total.
It was five chickens.
That's a lot of chickens.
Five trips
that's
back and forth to the hen house. It was quite something. So the listeners understand, the chickens are free range, sort of free range. They go out during the day, and the door closed to the coop, the building that the coop is in, so they couldn't get back in. So that rather than go in the barn, like a smart bird would do, they went up in a tree. And they all had to be pulled out one by one, because I didn't want them out late at night. There's a fisher that roams the countryside up there. So
Thank goodness for you and for your for your poultry efforts.
I'm sure they're saying that
Did
this
morning.
Did
you have to set up a ladder to climb up there?
No, fortunately they went to one of the low branches and I was able
to
reach.
Well, that's good. And they all sit in a row and
they do.
Wait to be picked
except
up?
Except for one, who always, I don't know what's going on with her. She's a loner or something, but she goes off. When she's in the coop, she always stays away from the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And in the tree, she was on a different branch. I don't know why.
Poor conversationalist, probably.
It could be. It could be she's just, I need my space. I don't know.
Maybe she's just had enough right now.
Maybe
she's just she's just trying to get it together for Monday.
It could be.
Figure out what's going on. Marge Gallagher is with us, Ulster County Controller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundation of the Hudson Valley. And good morning, Marge. Pleasure to see.
Good morning.
You this morning.
So happy to be here. I'm looking forward to the weekend. I'm going to be going to Congressman Ryan's swearing in at the FDR Library on Saturday. And then on Monday morning, we're going to be at the Point of Praise Church in Kingston for an MLK breakfast, which is always just a great event. So it's not going to be a quiet weekend on my calendar, but it's going to be some uplifting things, which I'm looking forward to.
That's
and we need.
Good. Well, that's absolutely right. I just want to thank all of our panelists for whether you're coming from a short distance or a long distance. But just thinking of March, you're coming out from Ulster County, and we have so many of our panelists that drive more than an hour to come here, to work for free, and they're just so wonderful about it, and always prompt and on time, and I just thank you so much for doing this, not only for us but doing it for our listeners as well, and that goes for everyone who gives up, even if you live a little bit closer. But thank you very much. We'd really greatly appreciate it. All right, let's get to what is going on. I received an email about 20 minutes ago, and it said settlement reached, and I thought, oh good, finally. There's been a settlement in Gaza, and then I realized that it was from Rudy Giuliani, who saved his home. And I thought, that's not what I thought that was going to be. Started off fellow patriot, and I was like, I think I got the wrong email. So, but let us.
Oh gosh.
See, you can be snookered. So the Israeli Security Cabinet has approved the Gaza. Ceasefire deal. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said the deal, which is expected to be greenlit by the full cabinet later today, could go into effect as early as Sunday. This is after just 15 months of war, Gazans dream of returning home. And this has been a very up and down week, of course, where we had a ceasefire agreement. And then there were some last-minute complications, and then finally there was they came to a resolution in the disputes yesterday with the endorsement of the Security Cabinet, a small forum of senior ministers. The next step is for the full Israeli cabinet of more than 30 ministers to greenlight it, which they are expected to do in a meeting later today. Hamas said on Friday that there were no longer any barriers to the agreement. So we will take that hopefully as very positive news. Vera.
Yeah, I mean, it is an initial moment of relief, I have to say, because there's been so much suffering and death and destruction. So, let's lay out what is ahead. So today, the assumption is that the full cabinet will vote in favor of this agreement. Now, we will likely see that the security minister, Ben-Gvir, will step down and Netanyahu lose part of his ruling coalition. But we'll see how that shakes out in terms of the future Israeli government. But it was an essential deal to sign for to hold the country together because it was 15 long months. So what's going to happen? It is not that the agreement will be put in place immediately and we will see all of the hostages come out and all of the Palestinian prisoners to be released and the Israeli military move away out of Gaza, but it is a step-by-step process and at each step something could go terribly wrong. So the first step will be for three hostages to be released.
Right.
We don't know who they are. We don't know what kind of selection Hamas will make. Will they strategically release, very ill hostages? Will they release younger people? Will they release women? We have no concept and clarity, at least publicly, on that. We also don't know how quickly Israeli forces will pull back from heavily populated Palestinian Gazan cities and move out. We know that surrounding countries have pre-positioned, particularly Egypt has pre-positioned enormous amounts of trucks of aid, shelter, tents, food, fresh water, and borders will open pretty quickly for seriously injured Palestinians to be transferred to hospitals elsewhere. So let's hope it goes well tomorrow as a first step. I would wish it on all members of both Israeli society and Palestinian society that this deal will be put in place effectively and successfully, because I don't know what would happen after, if it falls apart.
Right. And it's a 45-day agreement.
Yes.
And so the hope then, of course, is that it goes beyond that.
Yeah.
and it sticks. But as we have learned just in the last 48 hours, we'll take one day at a time.
Yep. Things could go badly very quickly.
Right. March.
So I've been thinking about this in light of the United States and also listening to the panel yesterday talking about, you know, what happened with the Iran-Contra, Iran hostages.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just want to say I think it's been very strong that Biden and Blinken have remained very engaged right to the end. It is not going to be the same sort of posture that was, where it's all the credit is going to go to the new administration. Obviously, it's going to be shared between the two administrations. But I do feel like the opposition in Israel is in part, the opposition to the ceasefire is in part in order to drag things out to make sure that Trump is getting some credit for this process. And, it's unfortunate to think that additional lives are being lost at this time, because we don't have the ceasefire in place, and it's really to benefit this sort of political, framework in the United States. And that weighs on me a little bit heavily. But I think it'll be a huge relief for everybody. And, I heard this morning on NPR as I was driving in, somebody, I can't remember the commentator, saying, we need to separate these types of crises from what's happening in the United States, right? This is not something that is happening in the United States, but we've taken it on as if it is. And hopefully we can sort of get our feet under us and reposition ourselves in terms of just how gut-wrenching it is in the U.S.
Very
because of the ceasefire. Yeah.
Yes. Jay.
I'm really pessimistic about anything to do with Israel and Gaza. If this holds for 45 days what can happen under this happens, that'll be, a good interim step, a moment of relief for everybody. I don't know if it's going to last much longer than that. We had Pete Hegseth testifying this week, and he was very clear about whether the I assume this is the position of the Trump administration and probably the position of Netanyahu and the hawks and the right. And I'm not so sure it isn't a reasonable position that he wants Hamas eradicated completely and thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting dynamic to have a peace, you know, to be sort of having a lull, which is all this is going to be, mm-hmm. I think, you know, with an organization that you are determined to wipe out. You know, I think Israel and I think Netanyahu had hoped for a lot sooner than this, a complete and total defeat or surrender. And that is just not going to happen in this space. Mm-hmm. I think one of the sensitive things that's going to happen in the next few days is who's going to come home, what hostages are released. It was an interesting thing I read the other day that a lot of these people are dead. If dead bodies start being delivered,
I
don't think this is going to last very long. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a lot of outrage in Israel and, you know, and people here, as you said, you know, this is a war we're sort of fighting over here among ourselves, you know, because it's a perfect right-left, you know, binary thing. It, you know, people are trying to make it into that anyway. You know, the outrage will start immediately. Yeah. So,
can I comment on
yeah, we just have about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
So I wanted to say the pressure on Netanyahu is also very intense, and he will be blamed. So the society is angry in different ways, right? And a lot of citizens in Israel are also really angry at Netanyahu for having dragged it out and not gotten the hostages out. So the anger will be, you know, influencing civil society and voting behaviors. And we obviously know that Netanyahu is on trial at the moment for corruption charges. And there's a lot of fallout, I think, that we will see. And I agree with you. We have a hard time sort of identifying all the strands of rage that we will see. Now, on the question of eradicating Hamas, that may have been a goal, but you can't eradicate ideas.
Yeah.
And you know, Hamas might not exist in the near future as a name, as an organization, and certainly a lot of Palestinians are enraged with how they were used as human shields in this organization. But the idea of what Hamas stood for will live on because we have so many young people who lost all of their family members in the bombings, and so that is the most difficult thing to overcome.
We will pick up on this right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We love having you with us, and thank you for being here. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Just before the break, and kudos to Vera, because she brought us up right to like the exact second I needed her to read. She hit the post, as we say in radio. But you were talking about that this idea of, you know, eradicating Hamas. And is there anything else you wanted to add to that?
I wanted to say, obviously, I said eradicating Hamas as an idea is impossible. And in that sense, the Israeli military has said that all along. You know, we can get some of the leadership and we can do that. But now it's time to move on to stage two, which is figuring out what the future holds. And I have to say, I'm ever so slightly, I agree with everything you said, Jay. It's a very difficult time, and we may not want to be overly optimistic, but we should be optimistic about one thing. When you look at negotiation literature, and when you look at creating a post-war reality, the most successful realities emerge when both sides, in essence, lose and don't achieve all of their goals. Mm-hmm. So we are in this position. So I'm slightly more optimistic that we can find a path forward than you just expressed, although I see all of the strands that you laid out. But we have to see an election in Israel that creates a new, more hopeful future that protects you know, members are Arab Bedouins in Israel, Arab citizens in Israel also creates a sustainable future in the West Bank, because the West Bank has been, the population in the West Bank has been treated horribly as well. And we have now a complete Swiss cheese operation, which we had, you know, in essence before, but now it's gotten more difficult. The fact that Israeli military has permanently taken over the Golan Heights and now is mucking in Syria is also problematic to me, you know, expansionist in that sense. And I'm just very, based on the literature and the studies from other cases in the world, we have seen that this is a moment where we might have some positive outcome for the future. That's all I want to say.
Oh, cynical journalist, what say you?
Well, I go back to the release of the hostages and the likelihood that some of them are going to be coming home in coffins. The flip side of this, I know some people are going to say, well, there's no comparison. I do think there, in people's minds, there is a comparison when you talk about one person's devastation versus another person's devastation. It's felt very sincerely. When the Palestinian people start going home, what are they going home to?
Yeah.
You know, I want to get back to my home. Your home is a pile of rubble.
That's
most
correct.
Likely. And yeah. And the, you know, is it going to be the idea? Is the idea going to survive that this is the enemy? This is the only way we can look at them. Look what they did to my home. I have nothing left. Or is it going to be, is it all possible to find a way to move forward here? And I hope that people, I hope that there are voices in Israel, in the government of Israel, and maybe Netanyahu will lose the coalition and lose the power, and an election has to be held. And I hope if that happens that the politics in Israel, the politicians in Israel start talking about compassion and constructive compassion and rebuilding and how coexistence happens, including the West Bank. You're absolutely right.
I have a list of four things that kind of echo in my mind that I want to see. And rebuilding is at the top of that list. And aid comes next. Like what aid is going to actually come in to assist Gaza and to assist the Palestinians? What kind of governance are we going to see in Gaza? And that's really important. And then, you know, what about settlements? You know, are we going to continue to see settlement expansion, or is there going to be an agreement that they're going to hold off on that or stop that? And it doesn't feel right now like that's going to be the case, especially the way Israel's kind of acted over the last 6 weeks. So that's a concern. And then with respect to the hostages being, you know, some of the hostages being killed, I think there's a very good argument on behalf of the Palestinians and on behalf of Hamas and Hezbollah to say, well, you were bombing us. That's why hostages have been killed. So I don't think it just cuts in favor of Israel. You know, I don't think it just makes the Palestinians or Hamas or Hezbollah look bad. I think it makes Israel look bad, too, because they've been continuing to bomb. And then I just really miss the days when we didn't have leaders who were under investigation or charged with corruption. Okay, there's just way too many people on the list of topics that we're going to talk about today who are in that mode. You know, we have President Trump, we have, you know, Israeli leadership, we have, you know, leadership in New York City. And I find it hard to believe, as an elected official, that people can serve in their best work when they have charges hanging over their head. You cannot tell me that you are, you know, taking actions in the interest of the country only. And so people have divided loyalties, and that's really concerning for
absolutely
me.
Absolutely correct on that, because, I mean, we see it particularly in Israel. I mean, Netanyahu has used Hamas for years to strengthen his own position in government and puppeteered a lot of what eventually turned into a horrific, you know, assault on Israel with a horrific response, right? So, no, we can definitely see this again and again. If you are under indictment, investigation, if you're accused of a crime, you make decisions that are most beneficial to you and your political future or your freedom, right? And we see that shaping what is happening in Israel.
How so? I guess that's my. Yeah. What do you think Netanyahu would have done differently if he hadn't been under indictment?
I mean, forget about what's happened since October 7th. You know, some people feel October 7th itself was a result of actions that Netanyahu took or didn't take, or things that he overlooked or his administration did leading up to that date that benefited him politically and from a criminal justice point of view, rather than, you know, for the good of the country. And so maybe October 7th wouldn't have happened if he wasn't so worried about, you know, these charges.
So Netanyahu has been in bed with the most extreme right wing, I would call them neo-Nazi element of the Israeli society. He has supported criminals who have been leading the settler organizations. And he has allowed settlers to expand, take over lands, let them cut down olive groves, appropriate property that clearly people had papers from the Ottoman Empire period that they held the land and owned the land, but that was not accepted in the courts that were then under pressure by the right wing. So we can look at those kinds of elements. And the members of Israeli societies who have fought for justice, who have women's organizations, civilian groups, even mass protesters, mass groups of protesters who wanted to find a peaceful path forward and out of this horrific situation, have been in essence silenced by the violence and the rhetoric used by those right-wing organizations. So Israel itself has a very complicated, I would call it quasi-democratic system now, because they have allowed undemocratic voices to rise, and they have a system where over 30 parties run in parliament. When you have that many parties that get to compete with each other, they develop personality cults of leaders of these various extremist parties, and they no longer represent the interests of the entirety of Israel's community and society, but very specific regional interests. And that has really weakened and undermined the democratic principles in Israel, not entirely unfamiliar to us from a variety of other European countries and the United States, I must say.
I don't disagree with anything you said. I guess all I'm wondering is, I don't know that Netanyahu's legal problems are any better off than they were.
No, they're not better off now.
And that anything he has done is anything he wouldn't have done. I think he would still be just exacerbating the situation in the West Bank every day that he can.
But he may not care as much anymore now that Trump is in power.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I think he's got absolute.
I think in that sense, he can easily just leave Israel and live in the United States. Done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with his family, he can just leave and that's it. You know, he doesn't have to deal with it.
Which I'm sure propelled actions of Israel over the last 6 months to ensure or to support a Trump presidency, right? I mean, decisions were made in Israel that would benefit, you know, having Trump come back to office. And so it's really concerning that this, these activities in another country are driving electoral politics in the United States. But that's the way it seems to me.
Yeah. And, you know, the International Criminal Court indicted Netanyahu, obviously. And what is Trump interested in? Ridiculing the ICC rulings and bringing Netanyahu to the United States and not arresting him. You know, while the United States is not a signatory nation, it has complied with a number of its regulations. But, you know, Netanyahu can't as easily go to Europe. There are a number of countries that have said they wouldn't hand him over, but, you know, a number of countries will. And so the situation has become a little complicated globally for Netanyahu.
Not surprisingly, we have letters on this, and I'd like to get to those after a short break. We welcome your thoughts on this as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have letters on the subject that we're talking about, which is the obviously the apparent agreement, ceasefire agreement that that is moving forward, was announced and then paused and now seems to be moving forward again. We'll go to the letters. This one from John, to say that this is not happening in the United States is missing the point entirely. It's our weapons killing the women and children. You can't get more involved than that, other than boots on the ground.
I hear you. I'm the one who said that. I agree. You know, we definitely are culpable in the sense that we are providing support. But it's also been handled in a way in the United States that I think, you know, we provide support in many other countries. And you know, I just think that this has escalated. And it and I feel, and this is, you know, I'm not an expert, but I feel that there are interests outside of the United States taking advantage of the division through social media and other means to make us hate each other here instead of allowing us to work to a resolution internally in the country. So that's my response to that.
I don't think it's just outside forces. I think it's internal forces as well. You know, having watched the career of Elise Stefanik in particular, I mean, if anybody, you know, just personified the exploitation of an issue, it was her. I'm not questioning her sincerity in support of Israel. I'm questioning her sincerity in just the intensity of that and the way she went after university, including Harvard, which she just has an absolute grudge for. You know, it was just, very much internal as well.
People are using the conflict to further their other priorities. Yeah. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
We go to this letter from Thomas, who says, good morning, panel. I'm not sure what your panelist meant by her statement that the ideas behind Hamas will not die, even if Hamas itself is destroyed, and that this would be a good thing. Look at Hamas's website if you want to know what Hamas's ideas really are. Ideas in quotes. Its main idea is jihad. It wants to destroy the state of Israel. Indeed, it wants to wipe it from the face of the earth, quote unquote. That is it, no more, no less. To suggest that Hamas has some sort of positive freedom vibe is irresponsible.
So that was not the discussion we had on freedom vibe. What the discussion was that you cannot eradicate terrorist ideas that have been widespread from anything. If you look at the Taliban, if you look at Iran, if you look at the Haqqani network in Pakistan, if you examine ISIS in northern Iraq, if you are cutting across the entire Middle East, we have a fundamental concept that uses religious fanaticism to and has attached that to the idea that that is the only way to liberate Sunni Muslims. Now, excluding Iran, of course. You know, this is a concept that we have, anybody who looks at terrorism in the region, and I've spent a lot of time in a lot of these countries, if you look at ideas that permeate those societies, you can destroy an organization, or you think you militarily destroy an organization such as ISIS, but then they reappear. It could be through social media outreach. It could be that they travel. Obviously, ISIS is now stronger in Central Africa. They have moved around the world and find locations where populations are desperate for development, opportunities, access to education. And if you superimpose religious extremism with desperate needs in the population, you can succeed. And that's what I mean by destroy Hamas if you want to, and I hope that Hamas is, you know, we know their leadership has mostly been destroyed, but the ideas that they represent are not dead. And that's what we're worried about. And that's what we watch when you study terrorism all across the region and elsewhere. That's what you look for. what ideas survive and how are they interpreted and reinterpreted by populations that perhaps, and what I said was there's so many young boys, 8-9-year-old boys right now who've seen their fathers die in Gaza, their uncles, their family members destroyed. And so unless there's massive investment in housing, in educational opportunities, in counseling, and in creating some hope for the future for these young people, and of course that includes women, what can we expect but to see a new version of that to emerge in 20 years and go back to the same reality that we have right now? That's what I think all three of us are concerned about.
And I appreciate what the listener is saying, but if we simply look at it from our point of view, Hamas is bad, and this is what they represent, we miss the point. You have to see it from the point of view of a Palestinian. I cannot because I don't live there. I haven't been through this war personally. But there are reasons that Hamas has endured, and it's a simple reason to say, well, they haven't had a free election since the middle of the aughts, but since they were first elected. That's fine. And that they have also controlled the schools and they've controlled education and they've been, indoctrinating children from a very young age on hatred for Israel. And you can look at all that, but you can say it's not a freedom vibe. But to many Palestinians, I suspect they see a strong, militarized, armed group that does some humanitarian aid when it can. To help people. And that's what they see of Hamas. And if we don't see that, if we close our eyes to it out of ideology, out of taking sides, we're never going to help settle this problem. And that's what I worry about Trump. He doesn't understand the subtleties of this, or he doesn't at least even pretend to.
We'll go back to the letters and go to Bart, who says, what is the status of the tunnels and the weaponry and fighters in the tunnels?
Oh, most of the tunnels, most of the tunnels, the big ones have been, found, destroyed,
eradicated.
Searched,
yeah.
Eradicated, the weapons found, the weapons taken out. Most of that system has been destroyed. Now, I think small tunnels still exist and some, minor tunneling system is in place. But you know what? All I want to say is Israel has known about the tunnel system for over a decade and not done anything about it at the time, when in fact that was a major concern, right? So now I think most of the tunnels are, at least the big interconnecting tunnels that lead to out to Egypt, and towards Israel have been destroyed, yes.
We go to this letter from Diane, who says, if you are talking about Hamas and how they are choosing the hostages to be released, please also mention the huge number of convicted terrorists that Israel is releasing.
Yeah, I think it was 300.
I thought it was 3,000 people that they're holding
per,
administratively.
300 per
hostage.
Hostage,
yeah.
Is the exchange rate, I think.
Wow.
If I read that correctly. And yes, I mean, it is a number of very dangerous people. But then, that was negotiated. Obviously, mm-hmm. Israeli society wants its people back, preferably alive, but they also want their deceased back. And so Israel is willing to do this exchange, otherwise they wouldn't have agreed to it and the negotiations would have failed.
And these hostage releases, these hostage exchanges, these prisoner/hostage exchanges have always been lopsided that way. I think simply because Israel has a much bigger jail capacity and just holds a lot more people.
Mm-hmm.
Right or wrong. That's the numerical reality of it.
Yes. And I do agree with the letter writer in the sense that most frequently when you release people from long-term security jail facilities, they are very dangerous because they have been exposed to extreme marginalization and violence. Let me give you a counterexample. Or an example from another area. So I study a lot the development of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, and the Turkish government. Whenever the Turkish government arrested Kurdish youth fighters or suspected supporters of the PKK and put them in prison for 10 years and exposed them to various what we consider torture methods in security prisons, they came out having personally experienced pretty horrific things, and they were completely dedicated to dying for the cause. So I agree that this release will probably create future problems. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Gail writes, one more letter and then before we go over to the news at the top, and then we'll move on to other topics in our next hour. Gail writes, having just returned from 2 weeks in Tel Aviv, I can tell you that the anguish over October 7th and the continued imprisonment of the hostages is not diminished and is profound. Six hostages shot in the head, just one example, is cold-blooded murder at the hands of Hamas. The rebuilding of return hostages' lives, if even possible, will go about privately and quietly in Israel while the world watches what happens in Gaza.
And not just Israel, right? We understand that there could be some French citizens released right in the first round here.
Possibly. We don't know who's coming out, but you're right. This is what I think is, so essential for families in Israel, the release of these hostages, and I hope they will get as many people alive out, even if they are. I mean, I don't even know how many years or decades it might take of counseling. I mean, we've talked to some people who were recently released from 5 years in Russian prisons, or those that were held during the Carter years. At the last year of the Carter year in Iran, and the horrors they experienced, and how long it took for them to feel a sense of normalcy and the ability to function within in society and family. This is a long journey, and my heart goes out to all of those families.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after news with Ray Graff. Good morning, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We thank you very much for being with us. As always, it means a lot to us. You can be a part of the conversation by going to panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will have some breaking news that I want to get to in a moment, but first let me just reintroduce the group so you know all who is here. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Karius-Kelly. Editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and the Ulster County Controller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, joins us. We, during the break, learned that the Supreme Court has upheld the law to ban TikTok if it remains under Chinese ownership. This is not a huge surprise, but the ban would take effect as soon as this weekend. Donald Trump has asked the Supreme Court to delay TikTok's ban for sale law to give him an opportunity to act once he returns to the White House, which, of course, happens on Monday. So this is a waiting and seeing a little bit, but the Supreme Court again on Friday refusing to block a federal law that would effectively ban TikTok in the U.S. The justice's order was a blow for TikTok, prohibiting its operation in the lead-up to Monday's inauguration of President Trump, who had promised to, quote, save the app.
You know, I don't like to be cynical when it comes to our president-elect, but, The potential irony of all this is really interesting. So American companies get in trouble sometimes when they get caught doing this. But one of the realities of doing business in China is there's a lot of bribery that goes on, over at the Times Union, as an editorial board, have often described campaign contribution, the whole campaign contribution system, as legalized bribery. And I would suspect that one of the reasons that Trump would like a delay is to soak TikTok for all it's worth in terms of campaign contributions and other largesse to friends and loyalists and so forth, and then there will be a decision to save this app.
That is very, very cynical, yeah. And yet I have nothing to disprove it.
I have an even more cynical perspective. Yeah. I think they're angling to sell it to Elon Musk. I think he's going to bail out TikTok. I'm really worried about that.
Well,
he's expressed he's interested in it.
That on the show yesterday of that this sudden turnaround from Donald Trump on this issue does seem to go hand in hand with the ever presence of Elon Musk.
I mean, I think this just speaks to us needing digital antitrust more than ever. Lina Khan was doing that at the Federal Trade Commission. I'm so bummed out. We're going to miss her so much, and we're not going to see that level of enforcement or any enforcement of antitrust laws under Trump. And, you know, you have these mega enterprises that are running the show. Half, you know, a bunch of them are going to be sitting on the stage during the inauguration. It could not be more obvious.
There are going to be a lot of kids this weekend ticked off. TikToked off.
TikToked off.
Yes.
Well, Biden has said he's not going to. I think he has said he's not going to do this.
Right.
He's not going to enforce it, but it's only in his hands for one day. And, yeah. And I'm reading that Trump could delay for 90 days enforcement. But, I mean, at some point, he'll probably just use that to gain contributions
and turn it
over to somebody he likes.
I mean, the court ruling says it could happen as early as this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. Anything else you want to add to
that?
No,
I mean, I agree with what we've talked about so far. I think Elon Musk is definitely part of that larger conversation, which worries me to an extreme because he, I don't know how long this alliance will last, to be honest, because at some point there'll be a clash, but Elon Musk worries me about his influence on his attempted influence on other countries. We see that in the UK. We see that in the support for the alternative for Deutschland, the what I would call a neo-Nazi party that is, you know, trying to break into national government. And he also clearly benefits from the use of misinformation campaigns. And he now has a chance to sort of shape what commercial interests look like in the future. And that's sort of his lane. And I agree with what both of you said. This is a very dangerous moment for us. And we will see what the outcome is. I suspect there'll be infighting within the Republican Party on this particular issue.
If China is the enemy, this is the right law. And,
right.
But then the question becomes, I forgot that Musk was involved in this and potentially involved. Uh-huh. You know, for someone who is, at the right hand of the president, incoming president, it's quite a thought. I mean, we've been talking so much about, the system being weaponized and all the whining we've heard from about how corrupt everything is. I mean, this is the height of corruption if that happens.
I'm more worried about ownership of TikTok under Musk than I would be under the Chinese government. I mean, that's where I'm at. I'm more concerned about the health of the United States and propaganda reaching people through TikTok under Musk than Chinese influence.
So let's move on to another topic, and it's not going very far because I want to continue to talk about Elon Musk. But and I realize that in the last week and a half, I haven't gotten to say Doge enough, so I think I'll correct that this morning. Elon Musk's Doge weighs recommendations to cut federal diversity programs. This is an article from the Washington Post. President-elect Donald Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, is reviewing a conservative legal playbook to swiftly eliminate federal diversity programs, which argues that the initiatives are unconstitutional and distort spending. DOGE, a non-governmental group led by Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, and charged with slashing the size of federal government, is considering a 19-page report from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a right-wing civil rights nonprofit that identified more than $120 billion annually in what it said was diversity, equity, and inclusion spending, according to two people familiar with the conversations and who had a copy of the report that was obtained by the Washington Post. Policymakers are unlikely to eliminate all of that spending, said the people, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. But by removing federal designations that favor historically disadvantaged individuals or businesses, some DOGE backers believe they can find cost savings in federal contracts and grant programs. The 10 largest savings on programs in the Wisconsin Institute report has identified as diversity, equity, and inclusion, which I believe comes in at a price tag of $113 billion.
I don't think it's going to save as much money as they're postulating that it will. I tried to get to the detail behind the Wisconsin report, and I wasn't really able to do that. I'm not sure, you know, if it just takes a little bit more searching. But here's the thing. If you want to cut off support for black farmers, for example, and you're allocating that support to other farmers, you're still spending the money. And so there's areas where we're spending money that we're calling DEI, where it's if we just channel it to another expenditure, it's not going to be a real significant savings. I mean, I have to say my office is following the DOGE work because, of course, we're all about government efficiency in the comptroller's office. That's our goal for the county. But I haven't seen anything yet coming out that I really feel like is going to be a cost savings and something that we could actually take down to the local level or take, you know, lessons from. So, and in fact, I just got an email today. We're going to require DEI training now for all elected officials in Ulster County starting this year. And it's a full day. So we're spending more money on DEI locally.
You know, this is a small part of the thing, but the line that bothered me the most reading that story was somebody saying that if they were basically suggesting that if you need DEI programs, then you must be racist. That you're admitting you're racist, you're admitting you're misogynist. So maybe we should just shut your university down instead of wasting money on these programs. And I'm like, what? You know, it's the ultimate like anti-intellectual response to DEI. This is just another rebranding, I think, you know, a repackaging of the anti-affirmative action movement. And they just found a more – somehow acronyms are insidious. I don't know why, but they are. And by the way, I call it doggy.
Doggy.
And I'm looking forward to the day that I can say in a Ross Perot accent that doggy don't hunt.
Get along, little doggy.
Before I heard of this Doge, the only Doge I knew was the Doge of Venice.
Yes.
In charge, the main authority of the Republic of Venice. For like over 1,000 years. That was my familiarity with DOGE, but then I learned quickly. I think the most immediate effect actually has been on private corporations that are removing mostly web pages or their public commitment to DEI principles, which, you know, I think is often a sad reflection to having made a commitment to diversifying their leadership or the way they source their products or the way they make commitments to their customers. And so obviously it will be more important than ever for us as consumers to make those decisions. Where do we go to support, you know, where we spend our dollars and where do we pull back? You know?
And it's a fascinating. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It's a fascinating thing to watch this. I mean, yeah. One of the stores. I'm not gonna pick on them on the air. Yeah. But one of the stores I very occasionally shop at when I can't get what I need at a more local non-chain store.
Yeah.
Made a very public announcement about this, that they are scrapping their DEI programs. It's like, what is the statement here other than, you know, what they call, I have to always remind myself of the exact two words, anticipatory obedience, or just going with some sort of flow that they perceive to be, well, he won the election, so everything about this must be right, and we have to get with the times.
What are the plans for workforce development? That's what I don't understand. You know, birth rates are down, right? We're now majority minority births in the United States, and it's very hard to hire people. I know for me, I'm having a hard time recruiting, mm-hmm. and you know, we're seeing contractions in, you know, trying to get people to work. And this process of eliminating DEI is going to eliminate the pipeline of bringing, you know, a more diverse workforce to the table. So I don't really understand that. And it looks to me frighteningly like this broligarchy goal is to actually eliminate workforce, right? We're going to have AI doing everything. We're going to eliminate our ability to bring in, you know, black, brown, and other diverse
workers women?
To the table.
Are we not supposed to see women also having, if you're interested in being an auto mechanic, but you happen to be a woman, you can't pursue that kind of a job anymore. There's no training for you. There's or no employer who wants to actually give you a chance because this is a male-dominated environment and that's how we feel comfortable. I mean, what kinds of questions brings this? You know, out in all of us, this kind of policy.
And this DEI label is a way to undermine those effective leaders that we have in certain places right now to claim, just like we did with Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. We saw this where people were saying, you know, she was a DEI candidate when she had clearly had a huge bench of work in public service that qualified her for the position.
Right.
So, it's really concerning. And it's very, very wealthy people in charge.
I asked the question in an editorial a few years back when we saw the Moms for Liberty and the whole movement mm-hmm. of trying to get people elected to school boards in particular, and there were quite a few candidates in this region. And I simply asked it, are you against? Are you against diversity? Are you against equity? Are you against inclusion? I mean, what about this offends you so? Mm-hmm. That you don't want children to even know about this. And I've never gotten a really good answer to it. I have read some thoughtful pieces that talked about the excesses of DEI, and I don't disagree with them, but that's not an indictment of the whole idea.
I mean, the idea that the pie is limited and mm-hmm. if somebody gets a slice, you get less, right. is really what's driving this. And, you know, it's similar to, you know, the energy transition and thinking about, you know, workforce training and repositioning for coal workers. We're not good at that, right? And DEI is a good example where mm-hmm. we didn't speak well to white men in America about what DEI means for them. And we have to figure out a better way to do that. I think DEI as a term and as a phrase is really dead right now. We have mm-hmm. to rethink our communication style on these issues, and we need to do it in a way that's more inclusive of everybody, because it really left people out and it created a sour note for people.
Mm-hmm. And I think the whole concept of Make America Great Again was all about the fact that it conjured up ideas where white males were in power, were more in control. They were in control of the families. They were the bread earners. They were, the ones that had a commitment, a lifetime commitment by their employer. Be it on factory floors or elsewhere. And this idea that white males in particular, but male society largely, had an almost guaranteed position in society, that has been weakened all along. And that we seem to have communicated with DEI that they will slip more, mm-hmm. that their slice of power and control will be reduced further. And I think that has created a lot of anxiety.
Can I just, I want to go back to something Jay said about the company of making the statement about mm-hmm. moving back from DEI. But this corporate suck up is so My largest gasp was Coca-Cola. Mm. There is now a Donald Trump Coca-Cola bottle. Were you aware of this? They put this is the Coke Trump inauguration. I'm showing it to the, but you can easily see it online. And it's a Diet Coke. Please, it's a Diet Coke. This is a company that really put out quite a statement after January 6th, and saying that it was the ultimate insult to American freedom, and now has turned around and made the trip to Mar-a-Lago to present him with the first bottle off the run of the inaugural Coke bottle. Obviously, Coca-Cola is not the only. Put this away.
For those who aren't on the feed, Joe just put his Coke bottle away to the side anyway. Still within reach.
I did buy that before I knew, but I did. I mean, to see this over and over and over again, I mean, it is quite nauseating.
It's going to be very hard for consumers to shy away from companies that have caved to Trump. I that's just too ubiquitous right now, what's mm-hmm. going on in corporate America, this kowtowing. And I think corporate leadership understands they're going to be punished if they don't, right? So they're taking actions on behalf of their shareholders, anticipating what the future is going to be like. But for regular people who want to vote with their shopping dollars, it's going to become very challenging to shy away from those companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Joe with his Coke.
No, I know. I don't have the inaugural edition, though, I will say.
I can suggest Inca Cola. Try
okay.
that.
Okay. Yeah. All
yep.
right.
That's made I'm, in
I'm,
America.
I'm fine. I mean, yeah. but you're right. I mean, I am one of those people who mm-hmm. I'm very careful mm-hmm. about where I shop and what I
right.
do. I try to be. I have my what I feel are my mm-hmm. issues, and I then will
right.
Adhere to them. But to your point, March, that's going to get a lot harder.
And
it already is hard.
It already is hard, and I think Meta and Facebook is a perfect example. I see a lot of people trying to flee the platforms, Facebook and Instagram, to try to get away from what has happened with Zuckerberg sort of kowtowing to Trump. But on the other hand, I've also seen people lamenting that there is incredible usefulness, especially at the local level and in rural communities and communities of color, for these platforms that actually connect people, build community, and allow activism. And that maybe, this rapid flight from these platforms is not the best thing. I mean, anyone who's on Twitter or X can see just like what an abysmal thing it's turned into now that so many people have left that bring quality to it. So there's
so
negatives.
So off to TikTok. All right.
Yeah.
Well, so, blue sky.
Yeah, blue sky.
So what we see is a response to a transactional leadership style that's coming in, And for Coca-Cola, I find it very interesting. They have a lot of production facilities in other countries where they underpay their workers and have terrible treatment all along. And what I can say is that Coca-Cola is one of those companies that will probably be also under some kind of pressure to bring some of the facilities to the United States. And let's see how they do with that.
Great point. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up the show right after this. Good morning, and welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is 33 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we welcome you. We have about 15 minutes left. I thought I would put some time aside for the end of the program just to spend a few minutes with this panel, as obviously I mentioned we're off on Monday because of the holiday, but also because we'll be covering the inauguration, and NPR coverage will take over. And then, of course, after that, we'll be going full throttle on what's happening. So I thought while we had a quiet moment on this Friday morning before the weekend and before the holiday and before the inauguration, that we could just talk a little bit about the legacy of Joe Biden. And we saw a speech from the Oval Office this week, which I think was very powerful for many. I sent out an article last night to our group about the president seeking last minute moves that could be hard for Trump to undo, that worried about, I mean, not worried about, but trying to further stamp his legacy on his presidency, and looking at from clemency to conservation, that Biden is pushing to cement his legacy ahead of a successor determined to erase it. And that is the headline of the Washington Post article I sent out to our group. So I thought we could just talk a little bit about that. Here's the big thing. We don't know, right? We that's the funny we'll thing stick. About history. We don't know. But we'll see. But I did think we could talk a little bit and just go around the room for a moment and take a look at what you see as the legacy of Joe Biden and what it will mean for long range and short range future.
It's the economy, stupid. I keep going back to that phrase because we have a great economy right now. I know people feel left out. I know we have inequity, but by our traditional methods, our metrics, Biden is a tremendous success. We have low unemployment. You know, we have tremendous job creation, investment, stock market at an all-time high. So I just feel like we're going to look back at this period and go, oh, that's what a good economy was. And he's done tremendous work pulling us out of the COVID downturn. It could have been absolutely devastating. I predicted we were going into a Great Depression, honestly, and he changed course on that. And then I also feel like on Israel, he is holding firm until the end of his administration, and there is going to be credit that comes back to the Biden administration for obtaining the ceasefire that's happening now. And then all of these actions that he's taking at the last minute for clemency to preserve land, to give temporary protected status, to, you know, eliminate student loan debt. My concern is that we are all assuming that Trump is going to follow the rule of law. We're not all assuming, but we're going as if he's going to follow the rule of law.
Hope, right?
And, you know, that's just not the case here. He's not, the new administration is not going to wait the requisite number of days to really overturn certain regulations. We are dealing with a totally different playbook. So I think it's going to be much more confusing to see what the legacy will be in the short term.
Mm-hmm. So one, can I be slightly?
Just go to mic 5 there, Vera. I think we're,
oh,
there
good
you
Lord.
Go.
I took the wrong mic.
You're good.
Okay, this
go
is
ahead.
Not good.
You're okay. You're fine.
So I agree with, you know, most of what you said on the economy, however, and the traditional metrics about how we measure success, I think we need to revisit because we have seen a pattern now that I suspect will worsen under Trump, where we have the upper middle class and the elites benefiting, the super elites in particular, benefiting from what's to come, and they have figured out to benefit all along. Anyone who is lower middle class or poor does not hold stocks, does not have access to the same educational opportunities, often lives in rural, remote areas where hospitals have closed, where grocery stores have moved away, where you know, general family doctor practices could not sustain themselves. They had to drive longer distances, and they found that prices for goods increased tremendously. They're still very high, and they continue to rise at the moment, as a matter of fact. So living on one income or even two incomes has become impossible for families. So I happen to know families who now have multiple jobs, right? During the week and on weekends, they barely have a day of rest. And when they hear the traditional metrics about, oh, you know, the pay is up, the jobs are available and plentiful, and, you know, stock market investments have worked well. Well, it has worked well for, you know, anyone who's in the elite, who's highly educated, or has been traditionally middle class because they own a house. But housing costs have exploded. Rental costs have exploded. And that will not change. And so I fear we have the bifurcation of American society in an extreme way. And unfortunately, despite many, many good policies that were implemented under Biden, that is the one area that escaped his ability to slow down. Now, I mean, I think he did very well transitioning us out of the COVID crisis and COVID payments and COVID support. But once that disappeared, the middle class and lower middle class and the poor slipped further.
Vera, I completely agree that some people need to have less. I just am afraid that we're going to look back on this period and say it wasn't as bad as it's going to get.
As we might see, it's
going to get. Yeah.
And I think we share that fear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing with the economy or the perception of the economy also applies to crime. You know, we're coming out of a pretty intense political season where people are telling you what to believe, basically. And so a lot of people who are perfectly fine, if you look at a typical Trump rally, it's a lot of people who are not suffering. Mm-hmm. They may not be wealthy, but they're comfortable. And they're talking about how awful their lives are. And it's... You know, it's this drumbeat of it's not as good as as you can see right in front of you. It's not as good as the statistics say. It's not as good as the numbers say. It's bad. It's bad. It's bad. But it'll be amazing on January 21st. Joe, just to go back to your original goal with with the conversation, I mean, there really is a lot that has been accomplished. I think it was so complex to get us out of COVID that it was hard for Biden and it was hard for Harris to come down to simple messages like make America great again. We're going to create a massive infrastructure bill that is going to resonate for at least a decade. We're going to do this and it's going to pay dividends down the road. People don't want to hear that. They want to hear, I like Kathy Hochul's got it. I want to get a $500 check in your pocket.
Right.
But the things he has done just in recent days, from the monuments to protecting hundreds of thousands of acres, millions of acres, I think, of federal land, hundreds of thousands, to taking people off death row. I remember when Trump started ramping up executions, and it just felt so bloodthirsty to do that. Like, this was for the crowd. This was the red meat for the crowd. This was the Colosseum. Let's put people to death.
Yeah.
I think he's doing what he can right up until the last minute. But I think the big stuff, I think you're right, is going to take years. But history is going to look at this, at least near history is going to look at this and say, we're going to see those charts on social media and everyone will argue about it. You're just cherry picking the... last 5 years, you have to look at something else.
Trump will take credit. The infrastructure bill, the money is not rolled out yet, and the Trump administration is going to gain from that, unfortunately, even though it's really a Biden legacy.
And one of my other major concerns is, you know, I've worked for a long time with immigrant and refugee communities, and I just want to pose, who will do all the dirty work, deal with the toxic garbage that remains from all the foam the firefighters used in California, the burnt up, you know, houses, the debris, but immigrant labor. Who cleaned up after Katrina? It was often Mexican labor brought in, right? And who will do that in California in the following the Palisades fire and the other fires, the Hearst fire, and I can't remember all of the names, but it is immigrant labor. And if we begin to deport, if we begin to I'm not opposed to getting rid of people that have committed horrific crimes. You know, I think we all tend to be in agreement. Those people don't belong. But people that have lived here, people that have worked traditional jobs that are not generally carried out by American citizens, this could be one of those moments where we begin to realize we are in for a tough future.
Yeah. And when we look at the Biden legacy, I think it's almost the opposite of what we are seeing and have been seeing over the last few weeks with the Carter legacy. Carter left the White House as a fairly young man and had many, many years to work on a variety of projects. Mm-hmm. This is Biden front-ended and went into mm-hmm. went into politics at a very young age, succeeded in the Senate and then of course as vice mm-hmm. president and president, and now hopefully he will live out a long and healthy life beyond that. But how active he will be on the international or national stage remains to be seen. But it is a difference because we'll be mm-hmm. looking at that legacy from basically the beginning of his political life to the end of his presidency.
And we're going to have an administration and an effort, a MAGA effort, to rewrite history right
Absolutely.
Now. And, so it's going to be very hard to get good information about what the accomplishments were and what their impacts were.
Well, we are going to end there on this Friday morning. My thanks to our great group. I just want to remind you once again about the Lockbox. And we are engaged in Lockbox time. And what that means is that every dollar that you give us now is less that we're going to have to make during the actual fund drive, which is on February 3rd, starting February 3rd. We have a lot of money to make. It's $1.2 million. I think we're somewhere around just about $380, $390 in the bank. So we need your help. And there are huge issues that are going to be coming up in just, starting Monday, we're going to be hearing a lot about a lot of stuff. And whatever we can do to keep us going and not off the air, we want to do that. So if you can help us in any way possible, please do. WAMC.org, www.wamc.org, or 1-800-323-9262. In the meantime, let me thank our wonderful group this morning, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jay Jochnowitz, March Gallagher. You've all been wonderful. Thank you very much for being here. Great to have you. Have a beautiful weekend.
Thanks,
have a
Joe.
Beautiful holiday weekend. Yeah. And look forward to your next go-round.
Yeah.
We'll return right after this.